along the way called Farewell My Subaru. Full disclosure here, I know Doug from my days in Alaska when he was trying his best to be an Alaskan mountain man, and he's got a book about that too. But this off-grid quest has been his holy grail for a few years now, and I'm finally getting to check it out. My wife and I showed up on a rare rainy day to get the full tour. So can you describe for me exactly where we are in the world right now?
So we are in southwest New Mexico, adjacent to the Gila National Forest and the 2-million-acre Gila Wilderness. This area has been pretty much completely alive and in ecological balance for almost a century. So it's just a wild, wonderful place.
It's a fairly big move. I mean, you're kind of out here by yourself. What was the motivation to do this?
When I lived in Alaska, I was catching all my winter's protein in salmon, wild salmon, and that felt great until I realized how much engine oil and gasoline I was dumping into various pristine waterways, and I wanted to see if I could reduce my hypocrisy level. And I've gotten pretty far. I mean, in terms of, I really probably have reduced my personal fossil fuel use, I don't know, 75 or 80% in a lot of different areas, food, energy consumption, and now driving. So I've made a lot of changes. I wouldn't say that I'm completely without hypocrisy yet, and I also wouldn't say that I'm totally self-sufficient. And if, God forbid, something bad happened and all of a sudden the crunchy organic co-op in Silver City went away, would I survive? I'll show you the garden. We can eat lunch totally from that garden.
Goat, you better not be in the rose bushes. Oh, they're not.
At some point, I will have to escape on short notice because they bashed down my rosebush green zone. And and they love the roses mainly because I don't want them in them. They have 41 acres of delicious, nutritious greenery here. And they go after the four rosebushes. I feel pretty comfortable right now that mistakes are going to happen and they're not going to be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And I'm just having a really good time doing it. I feel really happy having hands-on connection to my life, to my food and my energy. It's such a new concept, and it's not that hard. It's really not that hard. It does take a pretty big investment, though.
Were there any catastrophes early on, though?
Oh, yeah. There was the first time I tried to wire anything with solar power, I shocked myself so badly I could see through myself briefly. I smelled myself. I smelled pretty bad for like a couple of days. Like I smelled myself burning internally.
So what are you kind of hoping will be the message that people take away from the book you're writing?
You know, it's so funny. As I write it, I'm just really trying to entertain with stories of mistakes that I've made and little successes about reducing my own carbon footprint. But the reality is it's pretty easy to make a significant drop, and you can take it incrementally. What I tried to do in this book is show that a somewhat regular person can actually make a significant reduction in fossil fuel use, because a lot of the books that are either out or being written now are pretty extreme. Like, we wouldn't eat from outside a 10-mile radius for a year, or I'm never driving again. And this is, you know, maybe not practical for a soccer mom in Duluth or whatever. So you actually can incrementally get to that sort of extreme level amazingly fast without noticing it. I don't notice. Granted, the ranching part takes a lot of my day, but I don't notice that I'm on solar. I don't notice that much that I'm driving on vegetable oil. I guess what I hope people get from the book Farewell My Subaru is the realization that you can make incremental changes without drastically changing your lifestyle.
You can find out more about Doug, the Funky Butte Ranch, and the book Farewell My Subaru at DougFine.com. And that's our show for today. Our contributors were Lydia Wilson and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, with help from the Alaska Public Radio Network and KGNU. Special thanks to Deborah Beagle, Jim Russell, Paul Ingalls, Tristan Klum, Johanna DiBiase, and Flora Mack. Financial assistance from the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media and the Funding Exchange, with sponsorship from Good Radio Shows, Inc. Our show is produced by Blue Highway Productions in association with KUNM Albuquerque. For more about the show, visit BlueHighwaysRadio.org or email us at drive@BlueHighwaysRadio.org. Until next time, I'm Eric Mack, and don't forget, drive safe.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's the somewhat weak version of Bathurst Pier's Broadsides. You're dealing with a man with a fever here in the studio, so it's going to be a warm show, perhaps just as hot as the weather outside. Who knows? We have special guest Joshua Frank. at 6:30. And we're going to be having numerous other things, too. If you call in, we'll talk about them. We only have one line in the studio today. And so I'm encouraged by little notes posted on or about the studio to ask for donations. So send your donations, man. Go online to freakradio.org and give us lots of money. That's my pitch for donations. Stay tuned.
To smile in my direction from somewhere in the pale blue TV light, 'cause I left a little something in the kitchen and you said you'd pick up something from the store. But if you've moved an inch since I left here this morning, that's an inch more than you moved the day before. And I thought somehow that we could make a deal. We could spend a little time with Mother Nature, and we could spend a little time with Ronco Peel. And I tried to see beyond the ponderosa, but I couldn't change the way it made me feel. 'Cause the jokes on Mama's family aren't funny, and the fights on Jerry Springer aren't real. And I know that you'll be happy, yes, I know that you'll be happy with the Hogans, the Hakawi, and Hank Hill. Yes, I know that you'll be happy with the world of lifelike color, and I envy you the time you found to kill. If I thought there was a chance of good reception, I would try to think of something else to do. But the stuff that's between me and that antenna would take more than a Ginzu to cut through. 'Cause I could stand here in my birthday suit for hours, and I'm pretty sure that you would never see. But if I stood that way in front of the camcorder, I know that you would watch me on TV. And I know that you'll be happy, yes, I know that you'll be happy with your Cylons and your Vorlons and your Trill. Yes, I know that you'll be happy with the satellites and cables and a little extra network time to fill. So I'm coming to you now without commercials, in the only way to play this final scene. 'Cause the one time that you'll ever see this program will be here on tape to lay on your big screen. If I could buy you a remote for your remote, dear, maybe you would show some signs of life. Float the slightest smile in my direction from somewhere in the pale blue TV light. 'Cause I understand the need for television. I like PBS and CNN, but Gilligan will never leave that island, and Lassie won't be coming home again. But I know that you'll be happy, yes, I know that you'll be happy with your sisters Wendy Landers and Bert Trill. Yes, I know that you'll be happy with the world of motion pictures, just as sure as you'll be happy standing still. Know that you'll be happy with the world of motion pictures, just as sure as you'll be happy standing still.
And that was another Uncle Banzai number from the album Doug, which I'm gradually getting through and inflicting on you. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. I'm Robert Norris, and the name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. We have about 20 minutes, hopefully, until I get a call from writer Joshua Frank, and I'm going to be reading a bit of his writing before he comes on the air. I had hoped that he would have a debate with Metiana Bramana. You may remember Metiana was the Barack Obama supporter who campaigned against Ryan Coonerty as a delegate because of Coonerty's anti-homeless laws downtown and his repressive procedures at city council. And we were successful in blocking that candidacy, I think. Anyway, Metiana is a big supporter of Barack Obama. I'm not, and neither is Joshua Frank. The issue isn't Barack Obama. The issue is how to get out of the war in Iraq, how to end it as quickly as possible. How can we end it, since none of these politicians seem terribly interested in doing it? Today they voted, I believe, they either voted for another appropriation or they're about to vote for another appropriation. I'm having a little trouble in the studio because there's no internet here. there's no wireless here, and there's also no wired internet as well. So we have some difficulty. We also only have one line in, one phone line. And that may mean we may not be able to actually interview Joshua Frank today. I'm hoping that's not true, that he also will try the other line, but I can't be sure right now what's going to happen with that. So, some updates first, local updates, since this is a local show and we really are concerned with local issues. Bear with me today. I'm going to try to take it a little slower than usual because I have a fever and I'm a bit under the weather. I think it's the flu or something. But I've had about 100, somewhere between 100 and 102 all day, so I'm pooped. So, the first thing I want to talk about is Thomas Goodwin. Now, Thomas is a guy who has been in the studio before. He's been on the air. And he talked at one point about how he was pepper sprayed by a Metro security guard. He's a vet with a speech impediment, and it makes it look a bit like he's mocking people or kind of making faces at people, when in fact it's kind of like a facial tic that he has. And he was pepper sprayed at the Metro and then accused of battery when he called the police, and he made the mistake of pleading to that charge, that is to say accepting a no contest, and that was too bad. We were going to help him fight it, those of us in the human rights organization and HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. More recently, he has had a problem with the vets hall, where apparently one of the employees there grilled him on his bathroom use. And he pushed the guy out of his way to keep going, and then he got another battery charge and a trespass charge. He's going to be going to court on that one, too. So what happened today, as far as I know secondhand, because I wasn't down there, but Huff and the Human Rights Organization activists set up a table outside the Veterans Hall down on Front Street next to the post office downtown in Santa Cruz in order to determine if other people are experiencing similar problems in the Vets Hall. You who normally tune into the show know that I've played a lot of people who are critical of Tim Bratton, who is a I think he's either in charge of the building or he's a manager there. He's been accused of turning over the building to the yoga artists and making it a capitalist enterprise rather than a service for vets. He's been accused of yuppifying the place. And we wanted to find out how many people have specific concerns or problems with what's going on in the Vets Hall, because we've heard about them on the streets. And people who I've interviewed have talked about them. Now, I can't give you a report on that because I wasn't down there, but perhaps someone who was can. If anybody's listening in who was at that tabling, might want to call in and let us know how that tabling went, whether they found there was any concerns expressed about the Vets Hall and what was going on there, or Whether people seem to find the management was just fine. 427-3772 is the call-in number here, 427-FRSC. And if you want to donate $1,000, you can always call 427-4523. I'm supposed to put in a pitch for money. And apparently our equipment is really shot to shit, so we need some more equipment if we're going to continue the high level of service to which you have been accustomed. So kick down the bucks, folks, or maybe some equipment would be good, too. Again, the best way to do that is to go to freakradio.org on the website, or you can give a call, or you can mail a check to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz 95061. So, I did run into Thomas Goodwin downtown a couple of days ago and got this interview. I'm going to play it now, and it will save my voice and might also educate you.
I'm down here walking up Pacific Avenue and illegally riding his bike on the sidewalk is that notorious bike criminal.
And Thomas.
And Thomas, you, I know that you... You're facing in court, charges for having tried to use the bathroom at the Veterans Hall. And you have some vets organizations who are concerned about this issue and looking into it. But apparently the police also have an interest. You said you had a talk with Officer Peabody?
Yes.
How did that happen?
He woke me up in the morning and...
When was this?
It was Sunday.
Uh-huh. Today is Monday, of course, the 16th. Yesterday.
And he informed me that he won't give me a ticket if I stay away from the vet's hall. I get VA medical treatment and pick a bus to the VA hospital. And I have the county telling me I have to die and not get my medical treatment.
So wait a minute, did he say stay away from the vet's hall? Like maybe he meant don't sleep at the vet's hall, but he certainly didn't mean you shouldn't use the services during the day. Or was he unclear about that?
Oh, he meant totally.
And how do you know he meant totally?
They initially informed me that I can't even use the vet service office.
They being the vet's administration or the police officer?
The two police who cited me originally for trespassing.
Was Officer Peabody one of those?
No.
So he seemed to know you. Had he had previous contact with you in some other capacity?
No, that's why I was curious how he even knows me.
So, he didn't give you a camping ticket?
No, he said he would let me slide on the camping tickets if I don't.
He stayed away from the vet's hall.
Yeah, and I'm just like, I mean, it's not his fault. They're all in, I guess I'm like, they have a poster of me down at the station, evidently.
So,
I said they have a poster of me down at the station.
Well, that's because you're so good looking.
I know that. I mean, I'm GQ and all that.
You are the blonde surfer guy. You are the tramp of Pacific Avenue.
I understand that, you know, but...
You still, perhaps you wonder at the honor of being woken up by Peabody and informed to stay away from the vet's hall.
Right. I don't mind all that. I was just wondering how the... It's just, like, scary that he even knew that, like, everybody knows about it.
Did you intend to follow Peabody's suggestion and not go to the vet's hall?
Yes, I don't want any trouble. I'm in until this is ironed out. You know?
Aren't you a vet? Don't you have the right to go to the vet's hall?
No, they'll put me in the jail cell, and then what am I going to do?
Are you going to be tabling in front of the vet's hall on Thursday morning with us to inquire whether other people have had the same kind of strange problem when they cross swords with Tim Bratton?
Yeah, I'd rather fight it effectively than not being able to do anything at all and from a jail cell.
So does that mean you are going to be abandoning your First Amendment right to sit at a table in front of the vet's hall on the public sidewalk?
Yeah.
So you won't be there?
No, I'll be on the table. They can't do anything about the public sidewalk.
Right. So you're not... Even if Officer Peabody came up to you and said, we would prefer you not be at the table either, what would your response be to the good officer?
I don't care. It's my right. It's a free country, and I'm a veteran.
You would think also that your right as a veteran would be to use the vet's hall, too.
You would think so. But they also had a case of this in 1929 where there was a struggle between the veterans and the county or the state getting in the way, each other's way, and the veterans won back then. But evidently they forgot all about that.
So have you actually talked to any other vets other than Bob Patton of the Human Rights Organization? Have you been to any vets organizations to discuss this?
Yes, I have some veterans that have been treated like me also, and they're willing to testify.
It sounds promising. I guess you'll be... Oh, sorry.
I'm scared. Sorry.
That's okay. You'll probably be trying to get some... You'll probably be trying to get some more people lined up and hear their stories on Thursday morning when we're tabling in front of the vets hall?
Definitely. Hopefully.
Well, I have no further questions at this time unless you have any comments.
I think everything's going to work out in this case, and they'll change the parameters on the way this manager can treat veterans in the future. It's only one manager.
And who is that?
His name's Tim. I forget what his last name is.
Could it be Bratton?
That's it.
There you are. Thank you. And we're talking with?
Thomas Goodwin.
Thank you, Thomas.
And that was an interview from a couple days ago downtown. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org on the net. Coming up at 6:30, hopefully, is going to be an interview with author and political writer Joshua Frank. A couple of other updates before we reach that. Clive Bustrade, who has been on the air a number of times, he was convicted of some felony charges for driving up his private road at a few miles over the speed limit. And it's an interesting case. He came on the air a couple of weeks ago, and he was concerned that he was being evicted, according to the actions of Commissioner Irwin Joseph, the dictates of Commissioner Irwin Joseph. But the latest update was he was afraid they were going to come in and actually expel him with guns and lawyers, and apparently they didn't, and attorney Kate Wells helped him out. So he's still on his own property up there and still fighting for... he has an interest in civil rights for everybody in the area, and he does a thing called coppercards.com, in case you're interested. You can Google for coppercards.com and find out more about it. There was also a meeting, I guess it was... Was it last night or the night before? The Coalition Against Racism, Discrimination, Injustice, and all the other bad things that we know and hate. Kind of a discussion around the county. There are four different meetings. This is the second. It was held in Live Oak. And I'm going to be trying to reach Loy to get an update on how that went. It's of interest to me when people publicly talk about their experiences with the police, because I think it empowers people. And it's important. Lloyd has also put out a phone number as a cop watch kind of number. I should say a report police abuse number. Stop Police Abuse Now, perhaps, which is the organization I used to work with way back in the 90s. And his number is 457-2406 if you have an instance of police misconduct to report. 457-2406, 457-2406. So, other updates. Anita Henry, who is a medical marijuana provider with MedEx, the organization she actually single-handedly staffs, and also a member of the Measure K Commission, has sent me emails pointing out that she's tried to arrange a meeting with her city council member appointer, Mike Rotkin, to ask various questions about why the Measure K Commission was defanged, why it isn't meeting regularly, why it isn't following up on various issues, why it doesn't have access to police records and so forth. But so far, she has not gotten a response, apparently, from council member Rotkin. I've also gotten some emails from Donna Dice. You may remember Donna. Her story can be found on indiebay.org. D-O-N-N-A-D-I-S-S, Dice. And she was the one who had her arm broken by Sergeant Christian Lamas. She will be going to court on July 2nd. A court date has appeared. She will be charged with, I believe, battery, resisting arrest, and possession of marijuana. Pretty bogus set of charges is my conclusion after having looked over or listened to the witness's testimony. We'll be giving more updates as that happens. Andreas Nicholas is a guy who ran afoul of the parking lot panic law. Parking lot panic law is Mayor Coonerty's law that says you can't be in a parking lot at all unless you're walking directly through or you're in the process of parking your vehicle or retrieving your vehicle, and then only for 15 minutes. And Andreas was showing a First Amendment slideshow on the wall of the Community Credit Union about 10:30, 10 o'clock at night, a silent show, actually, so what didn't involve any kind of sound amplification, didn't bother anybody. But the police moved in to criminalize this under the Coonerty Ordinance, and Andreas is going to be going to court on the 27th of June for anybody who's interested. You can get in touch with him through Huff, 423-HUFF, if you want to offer any support. There's also a Fresno update. In Fresno, as you know, you regular listeners probably know, the federal judge there has ruled that the Santa Cruz procedures of seizing homeless property and destroying it are unconstitutional and actually a form of vandalism. They didn't use that word, but that's, in essence, I think, what they're saying. I guess they want to be courteous to those in authority and not call them official vandals. I think you got to call a spade, but in any case, there's a $2.3 million settlement going to the homeless and their lawyers. I've talked about that, and I'll be giving you more of an update on that Fresno situation after the interview with Joshua Frank, hopefully, if that interview happens. And again, I'm hoping that's going to happen at 6:30. But because we have phone problems here, it's possible that it won't. Let me give you some background on how this interview actually came about. I have an additional problem here in that I don't have access to the internet, so I can't really review directly the emails between Matea Bramana, the Obama supporter, and Joshua Frank, the Obama critic and a Counterpunch writer. He writes for Counterpunch website. But my issue, and the one I'm trying to really focus on here, is how do we get out of Iraq? How do we revitalize the anti-war movement and get somewhere, regardless of whatever politician wins in November? What's the best way to do that? And one way to do it is, of course, to focus more narrowly on the issue of Iraq. And so the kind of the proposed issue today, which I put online on indiebay.org, was something to the effect of resolve that electing Obama will or will not get us out of Iraq. Because for a lot of people, that's the big issue, although, of course, the economy is now looming large as well. So I can't really do justice to Matea's support for Obama, but he's agreed to come on the air in a week or two. Hopefully, maybe we can get Joshua to call in again, assuming he calls in this time, or assuming he can reach us this time. And if you are listening online, Joshua, call in at the 831-427-3772 number. Again, 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. Hopefully that will allow him to get through. Looks like we have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Josh Frank.
Hey, Joshua. Is it Joshua or Josh?
Either one.
Okay, I'll call
Joshua you. Joshua is probably the one to go by.
Okay, Joshua. Have you been ringing long? I just noticed that...
No, I just tried.
Oh, good. Okay, that's cool.
Well, how are you feeling?
a little bit under the weather, but hey, you're going to do most of the talking, so I'll just let you carry the show. I can't really, as I was saying, do justice to the other side's arguments because I don't believe them is my problem. And I wish I had someone in the studio who did, because that, you know, would make you, you know, a fit debating opponent or someone who could maybe, you know, go through go into the issues more deeply.
Right.
Let me first of all introduce you. You've written two books.
Written one book and also edited, just the most recent one's an edited volume with Jeffrey St. Clair.
And what are those books?
The first one is Left Out, How Liberals Helped Reelect George Bush, and that came out in 2005 on the Common Courage Press, and it's very similar topics to what we discussed in today. And the second one, Red State Rebels, it just rolled off the printers last week, put up by AK Press, and it's about grassroots resistance in the heartland is the subtitle, and it's about activism in the heartland, the flyover states, if you will.
Uh-huh. And you have your own, you have several websites that you regularly write for, right?
Yep. I've been a long-time contributor to Counterpunch, and obviously I've written for lots of different outlets, but most of my stuff appears in Counterpunch.
So those who want to follow what your thoughts are can go to Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org, and then just search for Joshua Frank, F-R-A-N-K, and check him out. I was looking up earlier this afternoon an article by Alexander Coburn from, I think it was last year, in which he talked about, you may remember the story, support their troops. Maybe you don't.
I'm not sure.
It's his concern that the anti-war movement in this country has become vitiated and is in essence dead almost because it doesn't want to even consider backing Iraqi insurgents or considering the variety of groups that have gotten together. I guess there was a meeting last summer, 2007, covered by UK Observer, and I mean, it's interesting. You very rarely hear any kind of discussion of the platform put out by Iraqi insurgents. Even among leftists, you don't see much of that. And
right.
Coburn did an article in which he denounced this, and in essence, it was saying support their troops.
Right.
And that was, I like that article.
Yeah, I remember it now that you mentioned it. I didn't remember the title of it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What's the story? Is the anti-war movement moribund in this country? Or let's say, why is it moribund?
I would say that the anti-war movement, its biggest problem is its inability to stick to its issues, and it so often gets co-opted by the Democratic Party. And I think we're seeing that happen right now with the Obama movement, Barack Obama in this case, the same as Howard Dean and even John Kerry later in 2004, is seen as sort of someone that's going to change the course of foreign policy in the region, especially in Iraq. And when you look at his policy positions, he's not exactly going to be doing that. If you listen to his speeches on what he thinks about Iran and how to deal with the potential quote-unquote threat that they pose to us and to other neighbors in the region. He's not differentiating himself from the neocon agenda and the Bush agenda very, very dramatically. And in fact, I would argue that given this, if he is elected, we may be more likely to see an Obama administration attack Iran more so than a McCain administration. And it goes back to your original question about what the anti-war movement is or in the United States or where it is at. And my fear is that if there is an election and Obama wins, everyone's going to sort of breathe a big sigh of relief that we finally have the Republicans out of office, out of the White House. All these last 8 years of Bush have just been excruciatingly painful, and how much damage has he done to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, to environmental laws, to our, just the way that the world views us. They're going to sit back and just really be excited that we finally have some change and some hope. Brilliant marketing in the White House. And instead, we won't be keeping to our issues in this case, continuing to end the war, because obviously the war is going to continue on regardless of who's in office. Barack Obama has continuously supported it by rubber stamping the war funds over and over again. I mean, if he really does not want this war to continue, he wouldn't be continuing to fund it, and he's been doing that. And obviously, I think with Iran, we've seen him turn very right on the issue in the past 4 years, especially since he was elected. He's taken a very hard stance and appeased the pro-Israel lobby by speaking to AIPAC about that he will do anything in his power to deal with the potential threat. And obviously, he's not going to take any options off the table, which means the potential for nuclear warfare. So, I mean, he's buying into the same rhetoric as the Bush administration, and then playing up the fear that they could do something to us. You know, it doesn't really, the facts don't matter apparently to Obama or those people that may support him. I guess, you know, because Iran does not have nuclear weapons. They don't have, they're not even close to that. And regardless, I mean, Israel has 200 and some nuclear warheads, so I don't see how, why Iran would ever want to commit suicide by developing a warhead and actually using it.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm looking over Coburn's article from a year ago. He's trying to consider what the difference is between the anti-war movement in the 60s and the anti-war movement in the 80s, and now here we are in this decade, the anti-war movement. And, you know, he points out there are a couple of different factors. One was the draft. You had a draft in the 60s, but you also had no draft in the 80s, and there was something of an active anti-war movement in the Democratic Congress, or I guess it was
right
majority.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think what he sort of gets at there is the new face of what movements look like, social movements look like in the United States, and the anti-war movement now is basically become an arm of the Democratic Party. MoveOn.org, Progressive Democrats of America, no longer are these activists on the streets enraged. They're online clicking and donating money and supporting candidates and thinking that that's how you bring about change when, unfortunately, I guess a lot of these people haven't studied social movement history in the United States. It happens at the grassroots level and not the net roots. I mean, I don't think that that's something that we really are understanding right now, that you can't support a candidate like Obama in this case without putting demands on his or her candidacy. Because in the end, they are going to be pulled in the opposite direction and take everybody that supports them for granted. The only way to put pressure on a candidate is to say to that candidate that we won't support you unless you take on our issues. And that's what you see Obama in front of AIPAC, and they're very brilliant at it. If the anti-war movement had the same strategy, they'd be a lot more successful.
AIPAC is the American-Israeli Political Action Committee?
Yeah, correct. Uh-huh. Right. And
explain what AIPAC is for folks who don't know.
Sure. Well, AIPAC is basically, it's a pro-Israel lobby. It has a very right-wing agenda. I don't believe actually represents the majority of Israeli opinion. They are for a Jewish state. They are greatly opposed to an equal one-state solution, and their two-state solution is very murky as well. They still want to occupy Jerusalem, and they want that to be undivided as well. They have a very, very militaristic approach to dealing with the peace in the Middle East. And unfortunately, they have a very strong lobbying presence in Washington, like a lot of other groups do, a lot of other corporations. But in this case, we see a candidate like Barack Obama. And I hear this argument all the time, you know, oh, well, you know, he has to speak to them because without that support, he can't get elected. Well, and then when you look at it and you turn it on the inside and look at the anti-war movement, and a lot of these people are part of the anti-war movement that say this to me, they say, well, the anti-war movement has to support him because we have no other choice. You know, we can't not support him because, you know, Ronald McCain's worse. Well, if we look at the rationale, it's a pretty weak rationale. I mean, the reason why Obama, the day after he accepts the nomination, goes to Washington to speak at the AIPAC annual convention is because if he doesn't do that, doesn't appease them, they won't support his candidacy. Because they know that they have the leverage and the power to take away their support if Obama doesn't appease them. think if the anti-war movement had the same sort of capacity and ability to do. I mean, we'd have, think if Obama had to come to an anti-war convention to get our support. No, but instead we give it to him blindly, and I think that gets back to your first question. You know, that to me is the main reason why the anti-war movement is so unsuccessful, and it's because of this lack of political activism and political motivation and understanding of what it is to really challenge power.
What is it to really challenge power?
To really challenge power, you have to be uncompromising in your intent. I mean, and that's why it's so easy to really learn this. I mean, you don't have to look at left-wing history. I mean, look at how the right has been so dominant in our culture for the past 20 years. I mean, look at most recently, look at AIPAC, for example. They are powerful because they are uncompromising in their approach to their agenda. And if the anti-war movement were able to do that, we would be successful. And instead, they think that you can challenge power by, you know, dealing with it on the inside, by running elections, getting inside the Democratic Party and changing it, instead of staying on the outside of the party and saying to them, look, we are willing to challenge you until you take on our issues. But instead, right now, what we see is, you know, we'll deal with that later. Let's get into the power first, and then we can change. And that's unfortunately not how a shift in power works in our so-called democracy.
Well, historically, in the 60s, was there that challenge from the outside that you see as so important?
I think there was to some extent, and it was at least in. It's not definitely not a similar parallel because the Democratic Party has moved pretty far to the right even since then. But we did see a lot of different activism that was approaching politics in a different way. And I think when you saw, like, in 68 and the approach that the vets took coming back, and their main concern was, let's get out of Vietnam. And it wasn't about who was in office. Obviously, at this time, it was Nixon. But obviously the Democrats are the ones that got us in there. It wasn't about, oh, let's elect candidates and let's change the – let's eventually get them out. No, the demand was now. Vietnam, let's bring them troops home now. And we don't see that same sort of passion today.
Yeah, but
and
didn't you have Bobby Kennedy and, McCarthy? There was a lot of energy poured into electoral campaigns.
There was a lot of energy put into electoral campaigns, but those are, I believe, a result of the grassroots movement and not necessarily a driving force of the movement, per se. And I think that's just what we're seeing now today with Barack Obama. I think the reason that Barack is so successful is because it's on the heels of this anti-war sentiment, or at least this sentiment of wanting change. Now, I believe he's exploiting it, and I don't believe he's really going to bring that change, but it's not coming from the top down. It's coming from the grassroots.
Now, Metiana, the guy who, the would-be debater who isn't in the studio because he had to take a plane up to Toronto because he has a job up there, wanted me to ask you to bring up kind of this point. He believes that Obama is, that nobody can win who's explicitly progressive, that you have to conceal your progressive principles in order to win, and that if you consider Obama's record, and I know you two had quite an exchange on the internet and in your emails about this. For Metiana, he thinks that, you know, Obama's record shows a lot of fundamentally progressive principles and also around the war. I don't agree with him, but that was his perspective. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think this is the most common argument that we face for people that, you know, whether it was in 2000 when people supported Nader or people that are in the Green Party or people that are trying to build a third force in American politics, especially on the progressive side, is that, well, you know, they're really progressive. So we have to support them because they're just saying what they have to do to get elected. Well, of course, we shouldn't always believe politicians, but let's go back and look at Obama's record. And let's look at it since he's been in Washington where he should have been standing up for these issues. Nuclear power. He's weak on nuclear power. He believes that it's something that we should consider in approaching the crisis of global warming. The banking industry. He's consistently supported policies that are pro-corporate. For instance, he's voted against a cap on credit card interest rates. And just if you go down the line, Obama has not really challenged the corporate domination of politics in Washington. And it's a really sad, sad thing. So I don't really understand the argument that, you know, Obama's really truly progressive. Well, if he's truly progressive, he's truly anti-war, why would he support allocating funds to continue the occupation of Iraq?
Is there anybody that you would support? I know you're probably not, but any Democrat, if you could run any Democrat based on his record, that you would believe would be more likely to get out of Iraq, who would that be?
That's alive today?
Yes.
I don't think that there's any Democrat right now. I mean, I honestly think that if we're just looking at Iraq and not thinking social policies or those sorts of things, I think there's actually Republicans that are more likely to get us out of Iraq. Chuck Hagel's probably one of them. I don't see any Democrats that are really speaking truth to power, and perhaps Dennis Kucinich would attempt to do it, although I think he's politically timid, and unfortunately we don't have Paul Wellstone in there anymore. And obviously Wellstone was very hawkish when it came to Israel, unfortunately. But I don't see any Democrats in Washington today that are really, really could bring us home and are willing to stick their neck out and ruin their reputation and challenge their party internally to do so.
Well, back in 2005, Murtha made proposals in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was looking to see what Obama's responses were to those proposals, and I haven't yet been able to track them down. Do you have any recollection?
His response wasn't overtly in support of Murtha, and that's why Obama is such a gifted politician, because he really waits until he sees which direction the wind's blowing to make his decision, and that to me shows that he's really and truly not a leader. He's a follower of this, you know, whatever popular sentiment or so-called popular sentiment is. But he did support the redeployment of troops, and he's adopted a lot of that into his current approach to the Middle East. And redeployment to me is really code for, well, it's not just to me, but it's code for putting troops in other regions in Iraq or in around the Middle East. So it's not bringing our troops home, per se. They're not going to be coming back to their families. They're still going to be in the Middle East ready to pounce on Iran. They're going to still be ready to attack if there's further warfare in Iraq. So this is not an end to a war. It's just a strategic change in the way that they're approaching war. It's not an end to it. And unfortunately, Murtha and a lot of people bought Murtha's line on that, and including some of my colleagues at Counterpunch.
Has Obama come out against? I think I lost my thought here. I was listening to Nader the other day on Democracy Now.
Mm-hmm.
He favors a six-month corporate and military withdrawal from Iraq, during which we negotiate with the Kurds, I'm quoting him, Shiites and Sunnis, for modest autonomy, which they worked out in the 1950s, this is new to me, before the dictators took over under a unified Iraq, continued humanitarian aid, some peacekeepers from nearby Islamic countries, and UN-sponsored elections. That way you knock the bottom out of the insurgency. What's your reaction to his proposal?
I think his only thing that he missed on that, and I don't believe he doesn't agree with this, but he just didn't mention it on Amy's show, was that once the corporate military occupation ends, the U.S. must pay repercussions to Iraqis for the damage that we've done. And I think he also noted that Iraqi oil must remain in Iraqi hands, and it should not be. And that's what he means, I think, partially for why we need to end the corporate occupation as well.
I remembered my question. I mean, there's been recent controversy about, was it 105 or 58 or 23 military bases that Bush is trying to maintain U.S., it's even sovereignty over, I would imagine, in Iraq. Has Obama made any statements on that? And if he has, can they be believed?
I'm not sure if he has made any statements on that per se. I know that he supports the military bases in Iraq. He supports the building of this construction of this massive, enormous, luxurious embassy, just a total waste of taxpayer dollars. That's going to be in the green zone in Iraq. So I don't think he would really see a difference in that. And he has not ever come out in opposition to the bloated Pentagon budget. So we can continue to see a military domination. And Jeremy Scahill at The Nation magazine has also written about Obama's plan, Iraq plan, that which would include the continuation of private mercenary forces in Iraq as well. so we're going to see just even more of a continuation of the corporate domination of our military. And of course, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with Blackwater, the mercenary force that's in Iraq right now, that's paid for by you and me, is not accountable to U.S. law, international law. They are at the behest of whoever, whatever they want to do. And it's damaging, having horribly damaging effects on the peace process in the region.
We're talking with Joshua Frank, author of Left Out, How Liberals Reelected George Bush and the More Recent Red State Rebels, which I haven't yet been able to find in my local bookstore, I might point out.
Yeah, well, it just rolled off the press last week, so probably take a few weeks before it reaches the bookstores there, but people can go on redstaterebels.org and check it out. And it's really a sort of a counter to the reason Jeff and I went about doing Red State Rebels was to try to get our heads above the electoral fray and take a deep breath and say, okay, you know, it's really easy to get caught up in the horse race every 4 years, but there's so much going on out there. There's so much going on in the heartland and the areas that we don't consider, you know, even sort of this invisible republic, as the Grail Marcus, the writer, calls it, that are really changing the course of American history. Whether we're talking about the fight against genetically modified crops in North Dakota, or people fighting against the death penalty in Texas, or people rebuilding their communities in New Orleans. I mean, these are the things that go on regardless of who's in office. And I think that it's good to keep that in perspective when we approach the election, because it's easy to forget there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done regardless.
It's interesting. You probably saw the story yesterday. Bipartisan accord reached on war funding bill. Which in essence.
Yeah, and this is what we're going to continue to see, even with Obama in office. And who's going to put pressure on him? I mean, and if we look back, we can't even look back and learn from recent history, and look at 2004 when John Kerry came out, and he was, if everyone can remember him, on the stage at the Democratic National Convention, holding hands with generals and saying that he was reporting for duty as he saluted the flag. And what did he do the whole time he ran against Bush? He tried to out-hawk Bush on Iraq. He didn't say that the war was fundamentally wrong. He said that he would just be a stricter hand on the helm of empire, not that he was going to actually, you know, sink the ship. He was only going to ensure that we were victorious there, when even at that point we weren't. And the anti-war movement was totally silent. There was no protest. There was no real uproar. And I believe, as I argued and left out, that's one of the big reasons why Kerry was unsuccessful in beating Bush, because he just couldn't invigorate people. And I guess it goes back to that other argument, too, that you mentioned earlier, that, well, we need someone that sort of has this interest rhetoric so that we can bring about change and so that they can get elected. Well, if that's really the case, then let's allow, we haven't really tried that little experiment. So let's allow someone like Ralph Nader in the debates. Let's get him on the televised debates and see how that changes them. Then we can really, you know, see if that sort of belief has any teeth to it. Get someone in there that's going to speak about real issues and issues that I believe is going to really excite a lot of people. I mean, right now we have almost 50% of the people that are eligible to vote in this country aren't voting. And my idea why, and I think a lot of people might agree, is that they just don't feel it's worthwhile to do, because when they do, they don't see any real change come from it. Well, those are the people we need to bring to the polls. And those are the people that need to be excited about politics and about our democracy. But I think, as Ralph says, you know, we have a democracy void, and people aren't participating because they don't see a reason to.
I'm looking at On the Issues, which is a lot of quotes from Barack Obama on war and peace. It's I'm not actually on the Internet, but I got a residue from the Internet. There's some quotes from him. He voted, of course, to confirm General David Petraeus, but he's claiming he will set the mission and give the generals a new mission. He'll take no options off the table if Iran attacks Israel. And he has a lot of, he makes a lot of statements like $2 trillion in the loss of life in Iraq are not sustainable. $2.7 billion each week of Iraq spending is unsustainable. humanitarian aid now for displaced Iraqis. Iraqi war has undermined our security. Iraq is distracting us from a host of global threats. End the war and end the mindset that got us into the war. So he sounds more determined, or at least his rhetoric is stronger about getting out of Iraq. What I notice, though, is the specific plan is kind of vague, to say the least.
Sure, and I think that if you look at the dates of those quotes, too, those were several years ago or even within the last couple of years, and he's changed dramatically his tune during his race against Hillary. And, I mean, if you look at the Israeli-Palestinian issue, when he was in the the legislature in Illinois, he was meeting with Edward Said, the great Palestinian intellectual, and really had a much more fair approach to the issue. And even as recent as last year, I believe, he was saying that he was really recognizing the difference in who is and who does not have power in the region and how asymmetrical the situation actually is, and said something to the effect that Palestinians are the ones that are being mostly hurt by the policies there. And, of course, the next day he's getting pressure and saying that he's, you know, people are criticizing him for being anti-Israel. So he flies to Washington to meet with the pro-Israel lobby and changes his tune. And it goes, this is the sort of thing that's happened to Obama, and I think that a lot of people, if you've watched the campaign, have noticed how much he's changed his rhetoric, and we're going to see it even more. I mean, was it yesterday or the day before that John McCain came after him and saying that he was going to be weak on terror, and of course they immediately respond saying, oh no, we're not going to be weak on terror, we're going to be strong, and we're going to use force when we need to use force. And we're going to continue to see this play out, even though the majority of Americans are sick of it. The war is completely unpopular, but again, unfortunately, the Democrats and now Barack Obama is saying, "Well, we can't let people think that we're weak on terror and on the war, because we won't get elected." Well, unfortunately, if that continues to play out, I think we'll see a replay of 2004 when John Kerry lost the election. Because what Obama needs to do is really stick up for his little branding of change in the Pope and instill that in people with actual policies and not sort of this lofty rhetoric. Because sooner or later, Americans, I don't believe, are as stupid as a lot of people think they are. And they'll see through this sort of cloud of smoke.
I'm looking at the 2008 Democratic debate in Las Vegas, January 15th. Obama's quoted as saying, "Get our troops out by the end of 2009. I have put forward a plan that will get our troops out by the end of 2009. We already saw today reports that the Iraqi minister suggests we're going to be in there at least until 2018, a decade-long commitment. Currently, we're spending $9 to $10 billion a month. The notion is we're going to sustain that at the same time as we're neglecting what we see happening in Afghanistan, where you have a luxury hotel in Kabul blown up by militants over and so on." So he apparently is saying get out by the end of 2009. He also says no permanent bases in Iraq. This was from, again, in the Las Vegas debate of January 15th. Mm-hmm. You don't believe him?
Well, I mean, what does he define by permanent? I mean, 100 years from now, if it's not there, is he happy? He's not halting the construction of military bases there, and he's definitely not. He's supported funding the war past 2009 already by some of the appropriation bills that he supported. The Democrats have solidified funding, I believe, until 2012. So not only do I not believe him, I don't see where in his actual voting record that backs his rhetoric up. And that's really unfortunate. And what does it mean? So we pull out of Iraq, which would be wonderful, and we bring our troops home, which would be wonderful. Well, then where does that leave Iran? And if you look at what he's been saying recently about Iran, I'd be afraid that troops leaving Iraq would just be going across the border.
Well, he has talked about increasing the size of the army by 100,000. And he has talked about, you know, striking in Pakistan.
Yeah.
He does talk about no permanent bases in Iraq. But what he does say is, we will not have permanent bases there. I will end the war as we understand it in combat missions, We're going to have to protect our embassy, the huge embassy. We're going to have to...
And then, exactly, and that's where it goes back to the military contractors. So we are going to pull out, and we're not going to have military bases that are funded, and the way we think about it, and he's very careful with his rhetoric, the way we approach this and the way we think about it, and a large part of that is going to be privatized. The military and the American occupation is going to be privatized.
He also adds, we're going to have some presence that allows us to strike if al-Qaeda is creating bases inside of Iraq. So I cannot guarantee that we're not going to have a strategic interest that I have to carry out as commander-in-chief to maintain some troop presence there.
Right.
But it's not Go ahead.
To me, that's not an end to the war. And I don't know who in their right mind could believe that that means that he's going to end the war. It's very well-crafted rhetoric, and it doesn't, to me, have any real teeth to it. And that's really unfortunate, because until he says that he's going to bring the troops home, which means back to their families, that he's going to pay reparations to Iraqi civilians, the anti-war movement should continue to put pressure on him and not support him without putting that pressure on him, which is what they're doing now. Because we'll continue to see him move rightward on this issue. He's at a place right now where he might be vulnerable, but unfortunately there's no pressure pulling him in the direction we should be pulling him in.
And that was one of the virtues of the Clinton campaign, much as I didn't like either of them, that at least they were critics of each other, and there was an opportunity to, you know, publicly criticize. Now it seems that, you know, it's a coronation. Here's another bit of information. Obama introduced a bill in May 2007 to begin troop redeployment in May. It failed, as he must have known it would, but he's been critical of Representative Murtha's calls for a quick withdrawal. Again, that strategy, tacking slightly to the left while attacking in the left to make his position seem centrist. He was an early critic of the Iraq invasion, and in the most recent vote to cut off funding for the war, he voted yes, but only at the last minute and without comment, following Hillary's lead. Accurate?
Right. I'm sorry?
I said, is that accurate?
That is accurate, yes. And at least all the research that I've done on the issue, he has continually shown that he wants to be seen as a centrist on this issue. And I believe since he's been running for president, he's even moved right of center. And it's funny, if you go down the line of all these issues and you kind of parallel him and set him up against John McCain, where are the really big differences? Other than the sort of the token issues that are really important issues like choice and Social Security, where are the real true differences between the two candidates? And I don't see them. Both support the death penalty. Both support the sort of notion of clean coal, which, of course, is not clean coal, and nuclear power as an option. Most recently, McCain said he doesn't want to drill off the shore, McCain does want to drill off the shore for more oil. Obama doesn't. But other than that, there's really when it comes down to the real core issues, especially the corporate control of our government, there's no real challenge within the Democratic Party, and Obama's not changing that, and McCain obviously isn't either. So. But where's the challenge from the outside? Where's this movement from the outside? And I'm not saying I'm supporting Ralph Nader, but I think that it could be a possibility that Ralph right now, his movement is growing. According to polls, he's about at 6%. And this was with a virtual media blackout. We have a guy that's polling at 6%. And I think it shows me that people are just sick of this corporate domination and the horse race that the Fox News and the New York Times shut down.
Is the 6% figure, you know, a Democracy Now and a Nader figure, or is it some independent figure you've seen?
No, that was a poll. There's been two polls, and the most recent one was by the Associated Press. But earlier, John Zogby had a poll that put Nader at about 5%. And I think a lot of people were skeptical at that point, but I think that the recent AP poll sort of validated the earlier polls, the earlier numbers. So it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. And if he continues to poll really well, I think they'll have a really difficult time of keeping him out of some of the sideline debates. Right now, I think Google is proposing to host an online debate and it may be televised as well. And I think that they would invite all candidates, at least the four major candidates. I think it would be Bob Barr, Nader, and Obama and McCain. And that would I think really shake up the election. It would really shake up American politics too. And I think Nader takes a lot of crap for continuing his fight, and they think that he's, you know, arrogant. And I spoke with him last week, and he told me, you know, he's not getting any love from the left. People are critical of him, and they think that he's just doing this for self-interest. He doesn't understand movement building and those sorts of things. But Nader really sees this as a crisis in American history. He sees that we don't have a true democracy. He thinks that it's not only ruining America, it's ruining this world. And he believes the only way to truly challenge that is by breaking the sort of electoral stranglehold on American politics. So he believes it's in his right, you know, duty to continue this fight. And so much as I do, I support that fight. And I support Bob Barr's fight. I support the Green Party's and Cynthia McKinney's fight to break
Ron?
Down the, you know, these walls that are holding back so many voices and choices in our election.
How about Ron Paul?
Absolutely. And, you know, we don't have to, if people are progressive on the left, they don't have to agree with Ron Paul, but I think Ron Paul was fantastic. If anybody watched the debates and the Republican debates, he made them exciting. Like, he was really in there talking about issues that none of the other candidates, Mitt Romney or Thompson, anybody else was willing to talk about or was willing to raise. And that's exciting. And people, and those ratings went up because as a result, and it's a reason why, you know, his book was number one when it came out on Amazon and why it's a New York Times bestseller, because people want a choice. They want a difference. They want real change. And unfortunately, I don't think that Ron Paul's change is the perfect type of change, but it definitely is a breath of fresh air in this sort of cloudy, murky election that we see every 4 years.
I guess the more important question now, we talk all about this electoral stuff, which is pretty gloomy. But what you've been researching is also what's happening at the grassroots level. And what's happening at the grassroots level around anti-war movements? Any words of encouragement here?
Sure. I mean, we have a piece in the Red State Rebels by Bob Mosier. It's on the activism that's going on in Kentucky. And in the anti-war movement there. And it really shows, you know, that it doesn't matter what kind of community you're in. I think it's really easy to be anti-war activist in Santa Cruz or in San Francisco or where I am down here in Southern California or in New York City. But it takes a lot more guts to stand up in the belly of the beast and hold your sign and take on power. We have another story in the book as well about what's going on in Indiana. John Blair, who's an activist there, was arrested during a Cheney event, I believe 3 years ago, and spent time in jail as a result. And these are the people that we really need to support, even if it's by proxy, because they're the ones that are out there. Those are the ones that are really changing American politics. Those are the ones that really are at the grassroots of the anti-war movement. I don't think the anti-war movement's heart is beating in San Francisco in the Mission District. It's beating when Cindy Sheehan camped outside of Bush's ranch in Texas. I mean, this is where it really, when we confront the right wing head on in the places that they call home, that are our home too, that's when I think we really can be inspired and move in the right direction to change the course of American history. So I hope that the book that we put together can help do that, at least shed some light on a lot of these people that I believe are doing the good work and the dirty work, and with, you know, dirt under their fingernails and mud on their boots, and they're out there in the trenches every day.
Turn to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. On the line with me is Joshua Frank. We're discussing how do we end the war in Iraq, and is Obama the man to do it, and if he isn't, as both of us agree he's not, how can that be done? I'm looking at this old story from Alexander Coburn a year ago. And he got some criticism for it. It was called support their troops. Instead of support our troops, go support their troops, because after all, they're the ones, the Iraqi resistance, that's throwing out the foreign occupiers, us. And what he got some criticism from Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, because she said, in essence, she supports ending U.S. sanctions, war, and invasion of Iraq, but she never supported Saddam Hussein, who was resisting the U.S. during the sanction years, and she doesn't support the Iraqi resistance today. What's the difference? We supported the NLF in Vietnam, the FMLN in Algeria, the ANC in South Africa out of principle, because we supported the social program they were fighting for. We may not have agreed with every position or every tactic, but we shared not only what they were fighting against, U.S.-backed dictatorships or U.S.-paid Contras or the devastation of apartheid, but what they were fighting for as well: independence and socialism in Vietnam, self-determination and social justice in Central America, a non-racial South Africa. Unfortunately, that's not the case with Iraq. Certainly, the Iraqi people have the right to resist an illegal occupation, including military resistance, and certainly there are Iraqi people, organizations, movements that many of us do support. The works of the U.S. Labor Against War and supporting the Iraqi oil workers' unions is one of our best examples. But what is broadly named the Iraqi resistance is a set of largely unconnected armed factions, including some who attack Iraqi civilians as much as they do occupation troops. There is no unified leadership that can speak for the resistance. There is no NLF or ANC or FMLN that can claim real leadership and is accountable to the Iraqi people as a whole. We know virtually nothing of what most of the factions stand for beyond opposition to the U.S. occupation. And for myself, of the little that we do know, I don't like so much. Any comments?
Well, I think that's a pretty common sort of analysis of Coburn's position there. I tend to sort of fall in the middle. I think that it's possible to support the mission of a lot of the insurgents, which is to get U.S. forces out of Iraq. And if you've read any of Patrick Coburn, Alexander Coburn's brother's stuff, and most recently in his book, Iraq, the Occupation, that was put out by Verso, his argument is that once the U.S. troops leave Iraq, that the violence will dramatically decrease. That right now what we're seeing is a sort of, not only is it not necessarily a traditional occupation, the Iraq, not the insurgency, the occupational forces there are really just one more militia in a country full of militias. So pulling one of those militias out, the one militia that is putting a cease and halting negotiations among factions there, will dramatically decrease the violence. So in that regard, I don't think it's ethically wrong. I don't think it's strategically wrong to say that you support the insurgency, and I would call it the resistance, because that's their ethical right to do so. If a people is occupied, they have the right to do so. Now, it's okay to be critical about their tactics. It's okay to be critical about the outcome, but when it comes down to what it means to be occupied and what it means to be free, it's absolutely their right to fight back.
Well, let's see. She continues, Coburn is wrong when he claims the peace movement is dead. How does he think that 70% anti-war opinion, he notes, was created? There are now 300 cities across the U.S., where dead movements, quote-unquote dead movements, have forced city councils and mayors to pass resolutions demanding that troops and National Guard be brought home, that money funding the war and occupation be brought home and reallocated to education, infrastructure, and health care. UFPJ, that's what, United for Peace and Justice, is coordinating regional mobilizations on October 27th, that was last year, and across the country, counter-recruitment work is escalating. Our movement is very much alive. It is nowhere near as strong as we must be to force an end to the U.S. occupation. But we are alive, searching for a clearer strategy to transform anti-war public opinion into real political power, to bring that 70% with us to support an entirely new U.S. foreign policy based on justice, not power. Well, I guess what I really want you to comment on, Josh, is this: is his response to her. He writes back, "Right now, I don't think the peace movement is advancing the end of the war in Iraq by a single day. In fact, goodly chunks of it are effectively protracting it by marching in lockstep with the Democratic Party, whose overseers strive on an hourly basis to tamp down seemingly criticism of what the party's congressional representatives could be doing, or unseemly criticism. What they have substantively done since the Democrats took over Congress is to have given the green light to the surge to continue funding for the war to the next Pentagon budget. And, of course, we saw this, you know, yesterday on the $150 billion war appropriation that got passed. Mm-hmm. Take the net roots. The organizers of the recently yearly COS event wouldn't even schedule a strategy session on ending the war in Iraq. They denied John Stauber's request that they put on the official schedule a strategy session. This has to do with, of course, internal, you know, stuff in the peace movement. Set that wimp out by Move On next to this paragraph from a New York Times news study. In other words, he's very critical of the idea that there has been any motion of this. I don't doubt Bennis's calendar is admirably full of speaking events, but from out here in the progressive Northwest, there's nothing much going on between San Francisco and the Canadian border. Yes, there have been useful actions in Olympia and Tacoma. That's when people blocked the Stryker Brigade equipment. But it's all awfully quiet. The mass mobilizations of 2003 seem light years away. In 2005, UFPJ raised over $1 million. In 2006, it only raised $575,000. Any comments?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Coburn's assessment of the decaying anti-war movement. I mean, I think he goes over the top and says it's completely dead. I think there are vibrant strains of it still left. And I think Cindy Sheehan's campaign against Pelosi is an example of that. But it's on life support. It's not, the heartbeat isn't there. And it doesn't have to do with a poll. A poll doesn't really indicate how effective the movement really is. So, yeah, so the sentiment is against the war in Iraq. But on the ground, where is it strategically making any real impact? And I'm sorry to say that that a city council passing a resolution to end the war isn't going to end the war. That might represent popular sentiment at a very small level there, but they're really not ending the war. And I think the continued allegiance to the Democratic Party is greatly the big reason why the anti-war movement is so unsuccessful at changing policy in Washington. Until the anti-war movement understands that you don't change policy by becoming a part of the problem, you have to stay separate and be part of the solution, that there's not going to be any really real change made at the congressional level when it comes to policy in the Middle East.
Well, I know that in Santa Cruz, I've occasionally get up at the city council and ask them to re-examine what investments they have in the city budget that go to war profiteers like Camp Dresser and McKee. They have a big desal project here in Santa Cruz, and they also have reportedly been, you know, profiteering in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. But you can't get local city councils to look into that stuff. They'll give it lip service, even Green Party members who are on the city council. But mm-hmm. you can't get action. You're in Long Beach?
Yes, I am.
Is there anything happening at a local level in terms of opposing the war that's noteworthy?
Very minimal. I've been here since August, and to tell you the truth, I have not seen much action whatsoever. And in fact, I see more support for Barack Obama than more people out there opposing the war. And I think it goes to the heart of what we're talking about, and that is that we have an election right now that is serving as a huge diversion from the issues at hand, and it's not representing the issues. It's not challenging those issues. It's not bringing the issues to light. Instead, it's submerging them into this muck of electoral politics. And instead of the anti-war movement being on the streets, and I would love to see mass mobilizations in Denver during the Democratic National Convention, much like they were in 2000 down here in L.A., putting people on the streets saying, enough is enough, we want change, we need to end this war. And there's no movement, there's no heartbeat that's calling for that. United for Peace and Justice isn't scheduling any protest outside of the Democratic National Convention.
Which they were back in 2004, right?
They were, but no one showed up. And it was very I don't believe that, and I believe it was in Boston, and no, I don't believe that there was any real mass mobilization in Boston whatsoever, and I was in New York at the time. Of course, all the money and energy was putting in to the Republican National Convention in New York and not against the Democrats, even though, I mean, let's remember, let's go back to when this war was signed off. The Democrats controlled the Senate. And that was after 2000. The Democrats actually controlled the Senate at the time, and they gave Bush the green light to whack Saddam for the slightest provocation. And that's the result of the Democratic Party's policies. So this is the party that the anti-war movement is now supporting, a party that has not only turned its back on us in 2002 with that bill, but has turned its back on us since 2006, since we, meaning voters, put them back in control of Congress and the Senate. What's been the outcome of that? I mean, I wonder what people would have to say. I mean, what's changed since 2006, since the Democrats have been in power? Have they done anything? Have they stopped funding the war? No. Have they instead given Bush all the money that he wants? Yes. Have they pulled Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root out of Iraq? No. And if you go down the line, they have done absolutely nothing. And, of course, they were ushered into power under the guise that they were actually going to do something about the war. And the same thing is going to play out again if Obama is elected. I think, should be frustrating for people that this is the sort of course that we're taking, even though it's been proven to be utterly ineffective.
Not a pleasant prospect here.
Well, I think the pleasant prospect is that, you know, your radio show's out there and we're talking about this, and not everybody is supporting Barack Obama, and a lot of people want to end the war, and they're not supporting any candidates. Ron Paul's movement, for instance, they want to end the war in Iraq, and I believe was probably more vibrant an anti-war candidate than any Democrat was. He had much more support than Dennis Kucinich, much more support than Mike Gravel. And he was out there. His supporters, his Ron Paulites, were out there chasing down Sean Hannity from Fox News and were crying foul when Ron Paul wasn't accepted into the debates. I believe that was in the New England. And this is a Republican. It just goes to show how timid the Democratic Party really is, that it takes a Republican to be the true anti-war voice of the election this year.
So you're going to be registering Republican for the next election, are you?
No, I don't believe I'm going to have to do that.
Wow. Well, Joshua, I appreciate your calling in. I know you want some time to sum up because we've been running through it point by point. Mediana Brahmana asked me to ask you if you'd have time in the future to do an actual interchange so you guys could clash swords, so to speak. Are you up for that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think that this is important, and I think people need to hear both sides. And I don't know what the other side is, unfortunately, because when it comes down to it, in my exchange with him previously, it came down to the fact that he admitted, yes, Obama doesn't have progressive rhetoric. Yes, you know, he does support the war, and he was very critical of Obama when it came to Israel. But my answer is, well, if we know these things, then why not hold their feet to the fire? Why not hold them accountable? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the Democrats are continually pulled into the military-industrial complex, into the shadow darkness of the military and the corporate takeover of Washington, and there's no progressive force pulling them in our direction. Instead, it's succumbing to this lesser evil politics, and in the end, the progressive movement, in this case the anti-war movement, has nothing, absolutely nothing to show for it. And until we stand our ground and don't give up, we will not see really any change at the national level. And that's a really unfortunate reality, and I think that Obama, in this case, has really sort of stolen the the passion of the progressive movement out from under it because of his hope and change rhetoric, and because so many people are so sick and tired of the Republicans in Washington, without really looking at who the enablers have been for the past 8 years. Who has supported the Supreme Court justices' nomination? The Democrats rubber stamped them. They could have put it up. They could have put a filibuster. The Democrats could end the war in Iraq by having a filibuster and ending the funding of this war. They haven't done it. And if you go down the line, the Democrats have not done anything to garner our support and our money and our grassroots energy. Yet we give it to them every 4 years, every congressional election we give it to them, and they give us nothing in return, absolutely nothing. So the strategy has not only been ineffective, it's also been damaging to the causes that we hold dear, whether it's people out there fighting against the death penalty or people fighting for environmental and social justice. They stick to their issues because they know that they can only do that by sticking to their issues and not sticking to party line politics, because in the end they get burned. And it's unfortunate that the anti-war movement can't learn the same lessons. So let's hope that they can in the future, and we can see some change and bring our troops home.
Well, in terms of what people can do today and tomorrow and the next day to help end the war, I remember talking with Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs, about a year or two ago, and his solution was to set up mass campouts in front of post offices throughout the country where people just wouldn't go away until the war ended, and a sort of a persistent presence. Of course, people don't want to do that. But the idea of, I mean, sort of like, I guess, you know, these, what was it, the Violet Revolution or the Green Revolution or the, all these purple, these different colored revolutions that supposedly happened in Eastern European countries where masses of people gathered around the centers of power and eventually produced a change. You see any hope in tactics like that?
Absolutely. And I think if we need to fight not only to get military recruiters out of our schools, we need to fight the military recruiters head on and go and sit in their offices. We need to go and sit in our congressional offices, our local congressional offices, and demand that our voices be heard and that this war end. I mean, these are our tax dollars at work here. It's our right to protest. And I think that at the local level, we can be very effective in doing that. And it would raise a lot of hackles if we were sitting in so-called progressive Democrats' offices demanding that they change their policies in the Middle East and their view of things there. And that's how you put pressure on them. You don't sit back on our hands and wait for them to come to us. We have to go to them and demand this change, because they're not going to be knocking on our door anytime soon listening to us. So, I mean, at the local level, there's a lot of things that we can do. And I think number one is if you have kids that are in school, make sure that there's not a military recruiter there at their high school, because, of course, that's where we can really make an impact. Make sure we get them out of there. Go to the local recruiting office and tell them that they're not welcome to be in your community. I mean, these are the little things that we can do. And not only that, I mean, stop writing checks to Barack Obama and other people that are planning on continuing to support the war. That's what we can do. If there's other candidates out there that people agree with more, go ahead and support them and work on their campaigns. There's little things that we can do, little pockets of resistance all over that I think are the new template for rebellion in this country. And everyone's sort of moving in a different direction, it may seem, but in the end, I think all of these sort of pockets of resistance are connected. And I think that through those pockets, we can see a real, true grassroots change and rebellion in this country. And I think it can happen, and it happens in our own backyards. And it doesn't happen in the confines of the voting booth.
Yeah, I agree with you. One final thing, one of the arguments that's always trotted out for why you should cast your vote for the Democrats is the Supreme Court. And that's, for example, the recent 5-4 decision allowing access to the federal courts for the Guantanamo tortured victims that are still being held there for 6 years. With a Republican Congress or a Republican majority, you know, you would get worse justices.
And we would, the Guantanamo detainees would see worse justice?
Right.
That's the argument.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating argument. I mean, but right now we have a right-wing Supreme Court, so I don't see that the Democrats are the ones that should take any credit for this at all. It's a Supreme Court decision. And where have the Democrats really been when it's come to Guantanamo until now? They were not there on the front lines saying that this was not only an elimination of habeas corpus, but they weren't even raising any sort of qualms about what was going on there in the torture there. They support the military bases in Iraq. Maybe they'd say that they don't want them to be permanent, but Barack Obama's not going to dismantle them next week if he were to be elected. So it's a typical thing that we see on the left. Every time that, you know, the right wing, and in this case I'm including the Democrats, are standing up for things that should be things that they oppose, right? I mean, you look at Social Security. Now the Democrats support Social Security. Republicans support Social Security. They want to privatize it. But those were progressive things. Now everyone, of course, they don't want to see they don't want to see segregation. Well, at the time, they did. These are all sort of the issues that become sort of in the subconscious of our national narrative, that it's always the left, I believe, that's pulled us in the right direction, and then later on, the right wing takes credit for bringing it about. And in this case, it's maybe a smaller level, but the Democrats are trying to take credit for something that was not theirs to take credit for.
Well, my point was rather that if you don't vote for Obama, you're going to get a worse Supreme Court that will tip the other way in the next 5-4 decision.
Well, I mean, that's a scare tactic. And let's say that there is a John McCain as president. And this is the same kind of rhetoric that we heard in 2000 when Gloria Steinem was bussed around telling everyone that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned and back alley abortions were going to be on every back alley of American cities if Gore wasn't going to be victorious. Well, when these right-wing nominations came about, John Roberts, the most recent one, I believe, the Democrats didn't halt it. They supported his nomination. So what's to say that in 4 years, if Barack Obama is in the White House, that we won't also have a very conservative justice approved? Or if John McCain happens to win and the Democrats continue to control the House and the Senate, who's to say that they aren't going to rubber stamp a right winger? And then in this case, John McCain might take the blame for it, but I think all of them should take the blame for it if they're approving him or her. So I don't see that. I see that as not only sort of trite, but I also see it as a scare tactic to scare people into believing that something's going to happen, even though it's sort of a non sequitur. There's no proof to that rationale.
Well, Joshua, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. You think you'll be free in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I'm going to be on the road next week, but in a few weeks I should be settled down and back at it.
Perhaps you'll have some news from the road that's more interesting and more encouraging.
Hopefully I'll have some encouraging news. And in July, we're going to be at the Labor Fest. I believe it's July 16th. We're going to be at Modern Times Books
in San Francisco
mm-hmm. Talking about the Red State Rebels. And Saul Landau and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is going to be there as well, two contributors to the book. And then we'll be at AK Press in Oakland as well in July. So we'll be up in the area, too, so hopefully listeners can come out. And
we'll come to Santa Cruz, and we'll take your picture in the station and send it to the FCC.
Perfect. Perfect.
Hey, we've been talking with Joshua Frank, who's an author, a writer, co-editor of DissidentVoice.org. He wrote Left Out, How Liberals Helped Re-elect George W. Bush. And along with Jeffrey St. Clair, he edited the now, I guess, in the bookstores, Red State Rebels, Tales of Grassroots Resistance in the Heartland. You can reach him through his website, brickburner.org. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, well, no, I think you covered it. And if anybody's interested in purchasing the book before it gets to your bookstore. They can go to akpress.org, and it's available through AK Press right now.
Thank you, Joshua.
Thanks so much.
All right, man.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Is dialing, and this time he really seems sure. All calm and content, all that drooling and smiling, and everyone knows that a romance is great. Cupid took aim at the couple ascending. Everyone knows that the tree is in straight, that the roots are all formed with habitual bending. Doug doesn't call anymore. He fell into love and he couldn't stop falling, and maybe he stopped keeping score. Maybe he's stubborn and maybe he's stalling, and everyone follows a poetic theme, the fork of the path that is usually taken. Everyone knows at the end of a dream, there's a hell of a chance that you'll finally awaken. Tie the knot, Doug, tie it tighter. Seal the package with a kiss. Open wide, Doug, open wider. Something might still come from this. Doug in step, Doug.
That was Doug Engaged from Uncle Banzai's CD, Doug. Well, it's Free Radio you're listening to, of course. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. We also stream at freakradio.org, and you can call in at 427-3772 on our one, count them, one phone line. Apparently our phone is in trouble, as is our internet. So we need your help. So if it's time for you to whip out the checkbook or, you know, hit the bank, send us some money in order to have your favorite radio station continue its forays in your direction. Boy, I hate this fundraising stuff. But it's still true. It's important to keep us going, I think. And we need money for equipment. Or we need equipment, I suppose. That's another possibility. If you want to help out, give a call to the voicemail, 427-4523. 427-4523. And maybe the techies there can tell you what they're looking for specifically. What could be helpful. So, again, the call-in number here, in case you want to comment on anything you've heard on the air, Joshua Frank, or perhaps the earlier interview with Thomas Goodwin, you can reach me at 427-3772. And until you do, I'm going to do some street interviews here. So, that's what we're going to hear next.
Talking to Ron, who is an aficionado of music, a former UC employer, a longtime Santa Cruz, and who was born employee. But employer, apparently John Laird worked under you one time, right?
Yes, John Laird.
And you're also an African-American.
Yes.
And you can testify that, as the mayor has said, there is no racial profiling at all in Santa Cruz, right?
It's not to my knowledge.
There you go. Yeah. So you are serious.
I'm very serious.
And what do you think of the music? You've been enjoying the music here. You say you came here last night, now you're here again. Are you a musician yourself?
Sort of, yes.
What do you play?
I play percussion and keyboard. This is me.
Well, you were saying you like the street scene, you like the people out here. I mean, you got a bunch of folks kind of hanging out, relaxing. Ne'er-do-wells like this character, John.
This is my family. All of them are my family.
I know.
I mean, this is the way I get my fix.
Have you come down to Pacific Avenue a lot, like in the last few years? I mean, like 30 years ago, were you also hanging out on Pacific Avenue?
Right here. 30 years, maybe 40.
Was windy and had brick planters.
Yeah. I've seen it being rearranged, you know, down through the years.
What's your sense of how it's changed? How would you describe that?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's just a lot of different faces and politics has changed a lot of things too, you know. Santa Cruz used to be like to me, I've seen it as a country club, a resort town, you know. I don't know, somehow politics come and go, you know. At one time they let everybody
go away, John, I want to talk to you.
They'll let people do their thing, and then at another time, you know, somebody get a wild hair up there behind. They want to rearrange the whole set and just destroy it. You know, it's like the people are having too much fun at a time.
Now, I asked you this question sort of in jest, but as an African-American in Santa Cruz, have you noticed much discrimination by police or by merchants?
Not me personally. I haven't noticed anything, but I've heard of it. I'm not really sure how true that is, because I haven't, you know, been an eyewitness to anything, but I've heard some things.
Well, you've been around for, what, now 50, 60 years?
Right? Yeah.
So you would have seen something in that period of time if you were personally impacted.
I haven't experienced anything, you know, but like I said, I've heard of it. Yeah, I don't have any problem.
That sounds good. Have you had any encounters with police in the last few years?
Not in the last 14 years, I haven't.
So you've been a good man.
I've been a good man.
You have kept your nose clean.
Very clean.
No murder, assassination.
Long of them around good musicians like...
You're pointing at this woman here. Valerie is her name.
Valerie.
I call her Vision Song Valerie.
Valerie's out here, and this is one of them. This Valerie right here, what's your last name?
Christy.
Valerie Christy. As long as I'm around people like this here, good time, and people like this, I'm at home. This is when I really feel like I'm at home in Santa Cruz. Born and raised, you know, on the streets. We like to jam, and if we can just get the city council and everybody else to back off.
Here, here.
Yeah. Let's do our thing. We'll keep the streets clean.
Well, thank you, Ron.
Maybe sometime they should come out And Jonas.
I've seen them out here.
Yeah.
They don't usually stay here very long.
They don't join us.
they pass too, and, you know, I've seen them too. Yeah.
Thank you, Ron.
Yeah. You're more than welcome. Yeah.
We have a complaint here from Meriwether Mike. Mike, what's the complaint?
Well, we haven't been rousing up the bookshop people with our activism. We got to pick it back up on Sundays.
Well, what are the issues you think that we should speak about?
The same issues that we've been kicking around for a while. You know, the camping, the sleeping, the ordinances, the same old, you know. The stuff that enough people aren't hearing about, and that's why we still, you know, have them.
Mike, you're out frequently on Monday and Tuesday nights playing, singing, just, you know, spreading the good word, the good energy. Have things changed in the last few years? Are they pretty much the same? What's your sense?
You know, it's funny how we just do it a day at a time out here, but I'd like to think we've improved some. You know, there's more people out.
Man, there's a bunch of folks over here that aren't, and I don't see any cops dispersing them. Looks like at least 10 or 15 people, a lot of backpacks, a lot of bags. Now, they aren't hanging around the musical scene specifically, but again, the musical scene is closing down. It's about 10:15 on the evening on Tuesday, June 3rd, I might add, 2008, for those who are wondering. But, I don't know. You see much of a change? I know you've been here an integral part of the musical scene for at least 4 years, right?
Yeah, well, we've been a part of it, just, you know, having a good time, meeting people, new songs, new experiences, and yeah, it's Santa Cruz, you know, it's always going to be what it is, and we just roll with it, you know, the issues, they'll come and go, and love's got to happen, you know, what else is there?
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Robert.
We're talking to that major knife man, your name, sir.
They call me Animal.
Yeah. An animal? Boy, you're another animal. There are several animals around here. I haven't seen the earlier animal. There's another animal.
There's two, me and my dad.
Is that your dad?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How's he doing?
He's all right. He's doing okay.
So you say you were jailed for a knife longer than 2 inches or 2 inches longer? Or?
They've decided that I'm public enemy number one, and I can't have a knife over 2 inches because I'm on parole.
And for those of you who have been listening regularly to my show, this is and the two previous interviews are interviews that have been played before and rather recently. This is what comes of coming to the station with a fever. You forget things, so forgive me for that. Let's have a little musical break, and maybe I'll be able to pipe up some new stuff for you.
Duck pets his dog. Dog watches Duck. Dog feels the stress. Duck gives dog bone. Dog sniffs his butt. While Duck gets dressed, dog seems impressed with Duck's cologne. Duck feeds his fish. Fish don't do shit. Fish don't play fetch. Duck hates fish so. Fish hides in fern while Duck has fits. Fish don't do shit. Fish got to go. First you're born, then you walk, then you Boy Scout, then you drive, then you drink, then you leave, then you marry, then you die. Duck calls to Mom. Mom checks his tie. Mom checks his breath. Duck looks so shifts weight. Mom hates first dates. Mom bites her tongue.
that was Doug's first date. And now back to the streets.
Green box over there too. I'm a hardcore criminal.
Well, you know, a couple of extra crimes here. So it's about 2:05 on June 8, 2008. We have a squad car 120 double parked blocking a road here next to Tampico Lounge and Kitchen. And we have an officer writing up another citation. I'm trying to get this officer's name.
Forbes, F-O-R-B-S.
Officer Forbes is writing up citations. And we have, you've been ticketed right now. What's your
name? Yes, I am Tilden Ball.
And what happened here? What crime actually was involved? You were in the shade here.
Municipal code infraction. We're sitting in the shade.
Sitting in the shade. In fact, the shade does kind of cover the side of Tampico's Kitchen and Lounge as the officer writes citations. One after his car, as I said, is parked blocking the crosswalk, so disabled people cannot cross here. There's no actual access here anymore because this squad car is blocking the road. Why? So six people can get tickets for what? Sitting in the shade. Apparently it's a crime to sit in the shade downtown on Sundays in Santa Cruz if you are 50 feet from an ATM.
You can run my name? Why not when it gets ran so much?
It's an interesting use of taxpayer money here. Special police behavior downtown, folks. Now, some people would think this is harassment.
It is. You know, my attorney's building a case of harassment against Santa Cruz City.
Talking with?
Yeah, I'm Christina.
What do you say? Christina, you just got a ticket?
Oh, yeah. Go check this out. Like, on the 21st of May, they arrested me for sitting on that green utility box.
And you're pointing to?
The green utility box behind that metro bench right there.
Okay, I can't see it, but I believe it.
Yeah. No, they arrested me, and I spent 3 hours in county jail for sitting on that box. Okay. I spent 3 hours listening to sheriffs laugh at Santa Cruz PD for arresting me for sitting on that green box.
You didn't have a warrant out?
No, I didn't have a warrant.
You weren't on probation or parole?
Nope, not at that time.
Oh ho! So since then you've gotten into worse trouble, eh?
I'm on probation
for
possession of an illegal knife.
Of an illegal knife? Can you show us the illegal?
Informal probation.
Informal probation.
So I don't even have a probation officer. But they arrested me for sitting on that box because I was repeating the same offense within 30 days. As a matter of fact, that officer just told me that if I get one more ticket within the next 30 days, he's going to book me into jail for it.
And again, the crime is?
Sitting within 50 feet of an ATM machine.
Now, this is usually meant to try to discourage people from harassing people. The ATM machine in question is around the corner. You're in no way,
I'm not even in...
You aren't visible to the people using...
the people that are using an ATM.
Right. Exactly. Yet this officer, Officer Forbes here, armed with a gun on his right hip, is giving two citations.
Six.
Actually, the last two, I guess I'd say, gave six. And this is taking up probably at least 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, I told him that I'm sure that there's probably about 9 people buying drugs, 2 people getting shot and killed, and probably like 10 women getting beaten the time it takes him to write 6 infraction citations.
Mm-hmm. And who else got it? Did you get a ticket too?
No.
Who else got a ticket? You get a ticket.
No.
You get a ticket.
Yeah.
What's your name, sir?
Sonny.
And, Sonny, is this your first criminal ATM ticket?
No.
So you're a repeat offender. What led you to this life of crime?
My legs were sore, and I wanted to sit down.
Too hot standing in the sun.
Yeah.
It is a warm day. It must be 80, 85 now.
They took out all our benches, and we're not allowed to sit anywhere in this county.
They did remove the bench that was here, didn't they, at the corner of...
They removed both of them.
There was one there, and there was one over on
that
side.
So the benches that are right kind of the boardwalk side of the metro, I'm not sure what the name of the street is here.
Well, we're on Pacific right now.
I don't think this one has a name.
It's an alleyway
next to Tampico's. The two benches have been removed. It looks like, again, the city is trying to engineer kind of a social cleansing policy going on here.
Oh, yeah, it's summer. They're getting ready for all the tourists, so they're kicking their local out.
So are you two have permanent addresses?
Yes.
Yes.
We're both locals.
You're
born and raised.
Yep. So here's another criminal leaving the scene of the crime. aren't you ashamed?
No.
Uh-oh, she's not ashamed. This could be a serious matter. So...
Why don't you get another ticket for littering?
I know. They gave one of my friends a ticket for spitting on the sidewalk and told him if he spit again, they were going to take him to jail the other day.
Spitting. Well, he was spitting because he was clearing his throat?
Yeah. Yep, he was clearing his throat and he was spitting. And as a matter of fact, the two officers only stopped because he used to be on parole. And they stopped just to harass him. And then once he spit on the sidewalk, they wrote him a ticket and he spit again. And they said, you do it one more time and we will take you to jail. There are no posted signs saying he cannot spit on the sidewalk. So he assumed it was okay.
A quick interview?
No.
Okay.
Not the interviewing type.
Right. So are these all folks you pretty much know?
Yeah.
And
we all hang out down here every day.
And have you been ticketed before? You've been ticketed before, but have they been ticketed before?
I don't know if they have. I don't think they have.
I know I have.
I even told the officer when he first came up that I was the only one that was warned today, so I should have been the only one that got a ticket. He felt the need to ticket everybody, though.
So how long have you been sitting in the shade here around the corner from Tampico's?
10 minutes.
And what did the officer say to you when he came up?
Can't you leave when I tell you to?
So in essence, the real motivation was not because you're get you to leave the area.
Yeah, they just want us to leave.
So you weren't following the orders of the officer was the primary problem.
Pretty much. It was just me. Out of all six of them, I was the only one that was told to move before.
And so Sonny, you said you weren't told to leave?
I wasn't here yet.
And yet you got a citation.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I told the officer I was the only one warned, let me take the ticket.
Before I took care of all my tickets, I had almost 45 citations in my pocket within like a two-month period.
And what was the majority of them for?
Riding
a bike, like with no helmet, on the wrong side of the street or on the sidewalk.
Any of them involve violence?
Nope.
Theft?
Nope.
Sleeping?
I have had one. I've had a couple sleeping.
So you admit to criminal sleeping?
Hello?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the update. If you, if anything else happens, let me give you a card you can call to make a further report of the latest shenanigans.
Okay. You're going to want to grab your backpack and your bike here in a minute because we have to start heading out.
Okay. Thanks.
Do you have a radio?
A radio show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'll be playing it on the radio. There you go.
That's cool.
The last victim of Officer Forbes is signing a citation for sitting too near an ATM machine, or let's say disobeying the will of the man with the gun. In Santa Cruz, that's criminal.
See your shirt.
Police Department downtown, protecting your rights. Check him out. Ticket for sitting in the shade. Aren't you going to apologize to the officer for sitting in the shade?
Heck no.
What's your name?
James.
James, so what happened here?
Just sitting down. I think it was a ticket for sitting on the corner.
Did he warn you, ask you to leave?
No.
Do you know him from before?
Nope. Don't know him. I don't even live around here. I live in Wasserman.
Wow. So what's your reaction? He just told you to have a good day. What do you think of that?
Fuck off. No. More or less.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
With
Kathy.
Kathy, you're a person who's been around the metro a lot.
Yeah, I'm homeless now, and they took the benches, and then they give everybody tickets to sit over by the wall. That's not fair. They harass the homeless all the time. They gave my son a ticket for spitting on the sidewalk the other day just because they both had attitudes with each other.
That's Sonny we're talking about?
No, my son's name is Justin.
Wow. And how long have you been around Santa Cruz yourself?
Since I was like 13.
And how old are you now?
44.
Oh, boy. So you must like it here?
Kind of. I like it here, but, I mean, it's just really expensive to live. And then they got to mess with the homeless people. That's my big issue, is I mess with the homeless people.
I'm glad that's your issue. I'll give you my card if you want. If you want to see any more incidents happening, you can report them to me.
Okay, sure, I will.
Okay. And again, we've been talking with
Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy.
And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides tonight, the feverish show. I'll hopefully be back on Sunday without a fever and with some more interesting items, if I can round them up. What I notice about this series of six tickets, it's clearly an attempt to use police power to drive people away. And it's something that I guess most people might say, yeah, well, it isn't happening to me, so who cares? But this is the kind of arbitrary authority where some guy with a uniform and a badge thinks he can order you around to do whatever he wants you to do, or at least to abandon your right to be in a public place because he doesn't want you there, even though you're not doing anything criminal, anything wrong. He finds a crime, and the crime, of course, that's found is this within 50 feet of an ATM where the people were sitting because the benches had been removed from the area around the metro right next to the shade of Tampico's. That's it for this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I see Dennis has brought me a beer, very sweet of him. And he's going to be loading up throughout the show. You'll probably need to give him a call and keep him seaworthy. I'll be back again on Sunday, and there's a meeting at the Human Rights Organization on Saturday, if you're interested, 2 o'clock, 131 Front Street at the Firefly Cafe. And you can call me off air at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Thanks for listening.
People are slaying, the woman is down. Picture perfect. Yes. Deep Purple. And hopefully you're not suffering from Deep Purple. I'm certainly not suffering from Deep Purple. I'm Uncle Dennis, and you're tuned in to a show called From the Cream to the Dregs, and we're going to play music for pretty much 3 hours tonight. I don't think I'm going to do the Earth First update. We may do some quick news at 9 o'clock about the tree sit, if I can figure out anything there, if anything happened up at the tree sit in Berkeley today. I don't know. Anyway, this is, of course, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org, and we will, I guess, just get right back to the music. We got the Brew of the Week coming up in 20 minutes or so, and then, of course, at 9 o'clock, we'll see what kind of Earth First update we can do. I have nothing prepared. I'm in a situation where I... can't do updates for the most part. And then, of course, at 10 o'clock, we'll have our Spotlight Group of the Week, and I have no idea what that is either. So, this is a totally play it by ear. What I do know is that tonight will be all vinyl. That's right. I'm not going to play one CD, DVD tonight at all. It's all going to be old tech tonight. So, stay tuned to Free Radio. Keep it locked. All vinyl tonight on From the Cream to the Dregs.
Outside my window is a tree. Outside my window is a tree. There only for me.
It stands in the gray of the city, no time for pity, for the tree only. Today.